I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jose Antonio Vargas about his new film, Documented. It's about his personal experience as an undocumented person in the U.S., and through that, a broader look at the entire debate over immigration. That's later. But first, we want to talk about another intensely emotional story that many people are talking about, and for that, we head to Sanford, Florida. That, of course, is the town where the self-appointed neighborhood watch volunteer George Zimmerman shot and killed an unarmed teenager named Trayvon Martin last year. After an investigation that many people felt went on too long, George Zimmerman was charged with second-degree murder. Jury selection began this week, and now it's been announced that the jury will be sequestered for the duration of the trial. And as we mentioned, this case has drawn intense interest and reaction from around the country, but we found ourselves wondering what this whole experience has been like for the people who live there. So we called the mayor of Sanford, Jeff Triplett, and he's with us now. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You've been the mayor for a little over a year when this happened. Do you mind if I ask, what went through your mind when you heard?
A little bit of shock, to be honest with you. You know, there's no handbook for what transpired, and when I heard the exact line was the train has left the station and there's nothing you can do to stop it. When you know, we heard people were coming to our town, it was a gut check moment, to be honest with you.
Gut check? How? What do you mean by that?
Well, because we weren't prepared for what was going to transpire. There was a lot of unknowns. One day we're a small town in Central Florida of, you know, about 55,000 people, and the next day we have 30 media trucks from all around the nation and mm-hmm. broadcasting around the world about what was transpiring in our town.
You know, not long after the shooting, we caught up with Congresswoman Corrine Brown. She represents Florida's 5th District, used to be the 3rd, where Sanford is located. And this is what she said when she first heard about this.
One constituent came to Washington, and, you know, I met him at the airport, but he'd been to my office to tell me about it. White male. I'm finding parents concerned, brothers, sisters. It's a community that is very upset as to how this matter has been handled.
You know, in our broader conversation, Congresswoman Brown seemed to be saying that at first she didn't see it as necessarily a racial issue. For those who don't remember, George Zimmerman is a light-skinned Hispanic, some might say a white Hispanic, and Trayvon Martin is African-American. So it's taken on racial overtones. She says that wasn't necessarily the case at the beginning. Do you agree?
I think that's a good comment. At the first, it was parents' concern that the investigation wasn't transpiring and making sure that it wasn't just going to be swept under the carpet. So that, I think that's a fair statement.
But do you feel that now it really has become polarized along racial lines, or do you still feel that perhaps that oversimplifies the case where you are?
I think it oversimplifies it a little bit. You know, it's almost like the bell curve. It started out as upset parents and upset community. You know, here's a young man that's been killed, you know, saying that he's murdered, and the shooter hasn't been put away or it doesn't look like he's going to go to a jury of his peers. And then it took on this whole racial overtone. But you know, as we sit right now in the city of Sanford, it's almost more of, this is what the demonstrations were for. We wanted him to sit in front of a jury of his peers, and that's what's transpired. I think it's opened up a whole lot of dialogue across the nation for race relations, though. It's almost, as we talk, it's almost that there was that, you know, festering wound underneath the scab, and this kind of pulled that scab off the top and let a lot of thoughts and history come out as to, race relations between the community and police departments, not just in Sanford, but in a lot of small and medium-sized communities around the nation.
Oh, I wanted to ask you about that. Is there something that you've learned or heard in the course of this that you just didn't know before, even though this is your town?
I was talking with one of the pastors yesterday, and you know, one of the African-American pastors, and we were talking about his history and what he's seen, and how when he found God that in his early 20s, that what his feelings towards white people and how he'd been treated were let go. You know, that was one of the first things that kind of animosity, that hatred, you know, that's one of the things that went away for him. And I told him, you know, as a white male, I can't walk in your shoes, pastor, but I can walk next to you. And what we have a hard time doing in leadership positions when someone has a problem or someone says, this is how I feel. We always say, well, here's what I'm going to do to correct that. We don't listen. And I think one of the great things that we've learned through all this is we've said, how can I understand what you're saying? How can we work to a solution together? And so a lot of that is happening in our community, a lot of listening and a lot of, a lot of healing going on and getting that off a lot of people's chest as to how they feel. And we're working down the path to help try to tie in take away the animosities or the lack of trust, not only between the police department and our communities, but also the administration, City Hall.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Jeff Triplett. He's the mayor of Sanford, Florida. That's where George Zimmerman is accused of shooting the unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin. His trial for second-degree murder is going on now. Mr. Mayor, what are you hearing from other people? I mean, I've been seeing in the local media that there are a lot of people on the African-American side are pleased because they feel that you're hearing them for the first time. As you mentioned, they're getting a chance to surface some feelings that they've had for a long time about the way they feel they've been treated by the police and by other people in the government. But what about other people? I mean, are there some people who feel that perhaps you're listening too much?
You've always that's the great thing about communities is you're always going to have people on either side of that table that think you're giving too much time to one or the other or what have you. And we not only are we listening, spending a lot of time in our African American communities. We did a community meeting in our historic district the other night. About 100 residents showed up, and they stated their issues. And our new police chief did a wonderful job of, there's some crime issues. There, it's summertime. There's a lot of teens on the streets. So some houses were being robbed, and it looked like it was the same people doing that. And he got out in front of it and said, listen, that was exactly one of the comments was, you're paying all this attention to these other communities. What about us? And he said, here's exactly what we're doing. And 2 days later, we caught the group that were doing those robberies. So it's really a balancing act, and you're going to have that, but it's really about, from the police department, the community support, everybody watching out for each other. And I think we've lost a little bit of that as time has gone on, with the fences and locking of the doors and not watching out for your neighbor. And I think we're trying to get back. We're really pushing that from a community relations side is we have to watch out for ourselves and our neighbors.
As you were saying at the beginning, you didn't really anticipate this when you ran for mayor. This wasn't really kind of part of your thought about what you'd be doing. But now that you are in the thick of this, how do you think this experience has changed you? And how do you think this experience will change the community there?
Well, in through tragedy, you like to think that there's an opportunity, and I've become, in myself, I've always said that, on decisions that you make, you've got to be able to look yourself in the mirror the next day, and you got to be able to look yourself in the eye and say, I did what was right for the community as a whole. And I think what I've really learned, I grew up in a small town in Missouri. I've been down here about 20 years, but what we learned from our parents is to do the right thing, and if you're gonna sit around and try to get things done, take a leadership role in that. And what I've learned is you really got to listen, not just hear people, but you have to listen, and you have to create. You have to surround yourself with good people that are walking the same path as you. And I think we've really, for me personally, I think we're in a good position now with good people. A lot of community support on what's happening, a lot of good visioning programs in the city of Sanford. And I really think that when we talk 2 or 3 years down the road as to what has transpired in the city of Sanford, that it'll become a key point for the nation as to how it needs to be done. That's what I'd like to see.
Well, you kind of stole my thunder there. That was going to be my final question, which is if you and I get together, say, a year, two, three, let's say 5 years from now, whether you're still serving as mayor or not or in some other capacity, what kind of conversation do you think we'll be having about Sanford?
Well, I don't want this incident between two people to define what the city of Sanford is. And there's a lot of things going on. We've got a lot of great people. take a tragedy and create an opportunity. You know, some people say that any press is good press. We've had a lot of bad press, but it's taught us a little bit of inner strength. You know, all the city commissioners have come together, you know, the community with the visioning process, where we want to be, and to say, this is where we were. And it didn't happen overnight. You know, our city's 135 years old. We've got some skeletons in our closet. Every city has skeletons in their closet if you have any age behind you as a city. But we've identified those. We're not going to allow that to identify who we are as a nation. And here's what we've done from that point in time. You know, a lot of people have asked me, you know, what have you done over the last 16 months, you know, since the incident that happened in your town? There's no way to tell, but 5 years from now, I'll have some identifiable points that say this is who we are, and here's the definition of where we're going right now, where we stand right now, and where we're going in the next 20 years, whether I'm in office or not.
Well, Mr. Mayor, I hope we'll speak again.
Absolutely. Thank you for the call.
Jeff Triplett is mayor of Sanford, Florida. He joined us by phone from his office there. Mr. Mayor, once again, thank you again for taking the time.
Have a good day.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Later in the program, the Barbershop Guys will give us a fresh cut on the week's news. But first, it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. Today, our guest is a woman who is forging a new path in faith leadership. Ruth Belinsky Friedman is just 2 days away from being one of the first graduates of a program that's training women to take on leadership positions within the Orthodox Jewish tradition. She joins us now to talk about what that means, not just to her, but to Orthodoxy on the whole. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, first of all, how are you properly addressed?
So, as of Sunday, I will be going by the title of Maharat Ruth.
So, Maharat Ruth, and that means what? I think most people understand the term rabbi, so it's not the same as rabbi, or is it?
Great question. So Maharat is an acronym in Hebrew that stands for four Hebrew words. It's manhiga, hilchatit, ruchanit, toranit, which translates to a leader in halacha, in Jewish law, in spirituality, and in Torah, and in Jewish teaching.
And how is your position different from that of being a rabbi? I mean, I think people know that rabbi really means teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But people understand it as being kind of the leader of a congregation of the Jewish faith. In other traditions, there are women rabbis, and they go by the term rabbi. So can you help us understand what's distinctive about your role?
So I will be performing a whole array of tasks in the synagogue. I will be beginning a position of Maharat at Ohev Shalom, the National Synagogue in Washington, D.C., starting in August. And I will be doing teaching within the community, working on Shabbat-related activities, and really having a hand in the involvement to facilitate all different aspects of the synagogue's activities.
Is there anything you will not be asked to do?
Within Orthodoxy, women do not participate in three areas. Women do not lead services, nor count in a quorum for prayer that is required for communal prayer, and then also serve as witnesses to religious transactions, such as a marriage. That limitation on women's roles does not affect the position of leadership. It's not necessarily common or certainly required that the rabbi of a community be the person to lead services. So the fact that women do not participate in those areas does not limit the role of a spiritual leader of the community.
Well, who's been fulfilling this role now? I mean, presumably in the practice of Orthodox Judaism, as in the practice of other, you know, Orthodox religious traditions, men and women have different spheres, and sometimes worship is done together, sometimes worship is done separately, but presumably there's been a need for study now, there's been presumably a need for questions that are particularly sensitive for women. Who fulfills this role now in Orthodoxy?
Sometimes the wife of the rabbi would often serve as, like you said, the female presence, answering questions that may be sensitive to women and that a woman would want to share with another woman. many communities, especially in 2013, we see often that the wives of rabbis nowadays are very busy with their own professions, and that is a role that is certainly sometimes still present, but changing in many ways.
So I was going to ask you that. Is it that the wives of rabbis are not as interested in playing this role, or is it that congregations desire that a person fulfilling this role have the kind of training that a rabbi has?
I think the way that Yeshivat Maharad is different is that we seek to formalize that position. In other words, it's wonderful if, you know, there are wives of rabbis in the community and women who are educated and who want to get involved. That's fantastic, and that should not stop. But what we also want to do is to provide a comprehensive training for women who do want to serve formally in these capacities, who do want to be employed by the synagogue and to really be fully prepared for that role. And what we've seen is that synagogues, like I said, they desire that. They crave that presence.
We do understand that there is some controversy about yeshiva Maharat and the position in general, that there are some people within Orthodoxy who still don't think it's appropriate for people to be trained in this way or to serve in this way. I'm wondering why that is, given that, as you've mentioned, that women have served informally in this role. Often the wife of the rabbi, the rebbetzin, has served in that role. Why do you think that there's this pushback?
So Orthodox Judaism operates within the parameters of halacha, of Jewish law. At Yeshivat Maharat, we do not do anything that is beyond the confines of halacha, of the Jewish law, because like I mentioned, we do not lead services, for example. So we do not step out of that role. However, in many communities have not had that formal position of a woman serving as the spiritual leader of that congregation. And there are certain communities and individuals who feel that that is a break from tradition and that that is doing something new and something that Orthodoxy has not had be such a common thing so far. Mm-hmm. And therefore it's a deviation from what the community has done until now.
Do I have it right that your father is a rabbi?
Yes, he is.
And you're graduating on Father's Day. So nice present for him. I hope he still gets to play golf or whatever he does.
Okay, well, I'm making him fly to New York. So.
Whatever he is, right, exactly. Do you mind if I ask, how does he feel about this new undertaking of yours?
Thank God. He has been very, very supportive. He probably, like all good parents, was a little nervous at first about how it would impact my life. But he has been nothing but supportive and eager and excited.
What kinds of concerns does he have?
Well, when I started, it was 4 years ago. I was 24. I was not married. I was younger and just worrying that it was an immensely positive decision for me. And like I said, I've never regretted it for a second. But any good parent worries about their child when they're going to do something new. But it was only mild concern. I don't want to overplay that.
You are married now, right?
I am married now. It did not cause much of a hindrance.
No, he was worried that you wouldn't find a partner,
In the Orthodox communities, they say that you're a student at Yeshivat Maharat. Like I said, I've been very supported by the community, but it's still, you know, to say I'm the first woman in the program to train Orthodox women to be spiritual leaders does speak strongly to my character.
Hmm. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And happy Father's Day to your dad.
I will tell him you said that.
That was Ruth Belinsky Friedman. She is the soon-to-be Maharat at Ohev Shalom, the National Synagogue in Washington, D.C. She joined us from our bureau in New York. Soon-to-be Maharat Ruth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're switching gears now to another story that's emotional for many people, especially now as Congress continues to try to work through an overhaul of the country's immigration laws. Jose Antonio Vargas is living that debate. He was 12 when his mother sent him from the Philippines to live with his grandparents in the U.S. At 16, he discovered he did not have the legal right to be here, especially not to work here. And he kept that a secret for many years through college and even through his career as a journalist at the Washington Post, where he'd go on to win one of the industry's most prestigious awards, a Pulitzer Prize. But by 2011, he decided he could not keep the secret any longer. In a riveting essay in the New York Times Magazine, he decided to out himself as undocumented. Now he's gone on to co-direct a documentary about his experiences. The film is called Documented, and it premieres next week at the AFI Docs Film Festival in Washington, D.C. And he's with us now to tell us more about it. Jose Antonio Vargas, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
What do you want to say with this film that you haven't said elsewhere?
That's a really good question. You know, as you noted, we are having this historic very political debate on immigration. The Senate floor is debating it now. And I wanted to land in a way kind of an emotional wake-up call about what this issue really is about. I've spent about a little more than 2 years filming, and this actually is not – the film that is going to premiere at AFI Docs on next Friday is not really the film that I had intended to make at first, but it ended up the way that it had to be, I suppose. And to show people that, you know, this is not about Republican or Democrat. Immigration is not just about border security and the U.S.-Mexico border. I wanted to show a much more, you know, personal and much more family-oriented reality. You know, I haven't seen my mother for 20 years this coming August. She's been denied a visa to come here to the United States, and I can't leave because if I leave, there's no guarantee I'll be allowed back. So I sent a film crew to the Philippines to film her. You know, how do I direct a film if I can't even go to the Philippines to, film my own mother? Mm-hmm. So that's part of the film as well.
I just want to play a short clip from a different part of the film. This is from a rally that you attended for Mitt Romney back in 2011 in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And you're talking with a couple of Romney supporters. Let's listen to that.
I'm Jose. Nice to meet you.
You have a brother, Jose?
No, I do not.
Are you in line?
Sir, there's no line. I was brought here when I was 12.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I didn't have papers since I was 16. My grandparents, who are American citizens, didn't tell me. So I've been here.
Yeah.
I've been paying taxes since I was 18. I just want to be able, as you said, to get legal, to get in the back of a line somewhere.
Now, these people were actually, I think, pretty nice, even though the police were called and you were thrown out.
Yeah.
But nicely. But I did want to ask about the emotional side of it. I mean, how is it for you to have to continue to explain yourself time and time again?
You know, I've been traveling now. I've done about 130 events in 30 states in the past 2 years. And what has been abundantly clear to me as a journalist and as a filmmaker and also as an undocumented person in this country is, you know, immigration is by far the most controversial yet least understood issue in America. People just simply do not understand how the process works, which is why I get asked questions like, so what do you mean you're not Mexican? Or, you know, why can't you just make yourself legal? Why don't you get in the back of the line? You know, why did you have to get a driver's license when you know that it's not legal? So these kind of questions, I mean, for me, I mean, look, at the end of the day, people are busy living their lives to have to care about my life, right? Or the people next to them who don't have papers. But this kind of misinformation has fed this, you know, misperceptions about what this issue is about. It is exhausting to have to tell people all the time that, you know, I'm actually from the Philippines. I'm not from Mexico, you know. I got to tell you, by the way, traveling around the country, hearing people use illegal and Mexican interchangeably, just, you know, these illegal Mexicans, as if all undocumented people are from Mexico, right?
Or as if all Mexicans are undocumented.
Exactly. But again, it's like, it was astounding to me because, I mean, as you noted, I mean, these were kind people. You know, like I ended up speaking to a couple, an elderly couple in Cedar Rapids who were like, talk to Grassley, you know, talk to Senator Grassley. You know, he helped us with our daughter-in-law who came here from Britain. I'm like, you know, he can't do anything for me. I don't fit the profile of somebody that he can help, which is why I think that the American people, once they hear the stories – once you look them in the eye and tell them what the situation is, they want to help. But unfortunately, our politicians and our politics are getting in the way of that kind of a conversation.
But there are still a lot of people who feel it's just wrong. They feel that this is a nation of laws. I know you've heard this a million times. This is a nation of laws. And if
Absolutely.
You break the law, if you don't follow the law, then you really don't deserve any further consideration. For people who have that point of view, I mean, as painful as it is to hear it, what do you say?
Oh, no, I want to hear that. I mean, honestly, I mean, which is why when people tell me that, you know, I tell them, would you have preferred that I would have, you know, no one was threatening to out me about being undocumented. I could have just kept working, you know, and living what I was, you know, doing. But I couldn't lie anymore, you know. I mean, I'm not here to say that I didn't break any laws. I did. But the question is, so now what? Now what do we do, right? Do we just kick the 11 million people out? Do we provide a process in which they can actually, come forward and say, I'm here. I want to keep contributing. I want to keep paying, Social Security and paying taxes, because we do that. But I feel like we're not having this kind of honest conversation. And I don't even think we're on the same page.
Jose Antonio Vargas is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. He founded a nonprofit called Define American to facilitate conversations about immigration. He's the co-director of Documented, which premieres next Friday at the AFI Docs Film Festival. It used to be called Silver Docs in Washington, D.C. Jose Antonio Vargas, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now it's time for Back Talk. That's where we hear from you. Editor Ahmad Omar is back with us today. Ahmad, what's up?
Hey, Michelle. Earlier this week, we talked to a panel of women about how they feel when guys whistle at them or yell at them out on the street about how they look, that sort of thing.
Like, hey, like that?
Yeah, I could see how that would get annoying for sure.
Yeah.
But Michelle, after the conversation, we also heard from some guys. Khalil Riddick from Alexandria, Virginia wrote in. He says, as a man, I am highly annoyed at the inappropriate catcalling that men employ on the street towards women. It makes it much harder for the good guys to approach women in a respectful way. After a woman has dealt with being disrespected so many times in a given day, they tend to reject any subsequent approach, even when that person might be trying to be respectful.
Have you found that experience in your experience, too, or just your charm just overwhelms all?
I'd rather not say, but that's from Khalil. That's his point of view.
Okay, what else, Ahmad?
All right, we got a ton of letters after our music segment yesterday, Michelle. Let's have a quick listen to remind folks what we heard.
Quiet, baby, don't explain. There's nothing to gain. Skeet that leads thee down.
Well, to everybody who may have missed the top of the conversation, that person is Buica. She's a Spanish singer from the island of Mallorca. When she was a little girl, her choir instructor told her she sounded like a dog and shouldn't be singing. Well, looks like the haters were wrong.
Yeah, Michelle, we just heard her cover of Billie Holiday's Don't Explain. It's on her latest album, La Noche Más Larga. Honoré Jeffers from Norman, Oklahoma, tweeted us using the handle Black Library Girl. She said, I love Buica. I first heard her on NPR Music a couple of years ago. I was moved so much, I wept in a good way.
Well, thanks, Honoré. And thanks for that, Ahmad.
Thank you.
And remember, at Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can visit us online at npr.org/tellmemore. Please remember to leave us your name. We're on Twitter. Just look for Tell Me More NPR. Up next, we'll head to the barber shop. The guys will talk about how LeBron James and the Heat tied up the NBA Finals. And who can resist hearing what Kanye West is up to? That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer and culture critic Jimmy Israel, with us back in Washington, D.C. Also here in Washington, Paul Butler. He's a law professor at Georgetown University. Fernando Vila is the director of programming for Fusion. That's an ABC Univision venture, with us from Miami. And Michael Skolnick is the editor-in-chief of Global Grind, with us from New York. Take it, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Fellas, what's going on?
What's up, Jimmy? How are you, man?
Prince Paul.
Love that name as long as everybody gets the hip-hop reference.
And they won't. Fernando, how you living, all right?
Not bad, man, not bad.
Okay, well, all right. Well, before we get deep into some topics, I want to take a quick hit on last night's game. It was the turn of the three kings. Of the three kings minus two. Bosh, Wade, and LeBron James brought the heat back last night, Michelle.
You're doing really well with your arithmetic, Jimmy. I'm so proud.
Oh, but gosh.
Game four of the NBA Finals, the Miami Heat beat the San Antonio Spurs 109-93. Fans had been asking for the return of King James, and we saw it last night. This is what he said after the game.
We was desperate. Can't afford to go down 3-1 and then come here for game five. So, you know, we was desperate. That's all I got to say. We showed character once again.
You know, Michelle, I think they were desperate.
King Jimmy. You think they were desperate?
Yeah. I think they were desperate. Thank you for the tape, Michelle. You know, LeBron has a reputation for folding under pressure. You know, Scott Rabb, Esquire writer, he noted that for his book. So it's been a recurring tableau in his NBA career. So this, in my opinion, is kind of chance for him to overcome it. You know, he's either going to choke at the point, you know, or he's going to rise and again have that Neo moment. He's going to become a champion.
Doesn't he already have a championship? He's got one more ring than I have. I mean, one more championship ring than I have. Hello.
But that could have been a fluke. I mean, that very easily could have been a fluke.
Jimmy, he's
best known as a choker. You know, maybe an all-night choker, but, yo, this brother, you know, he's just not particularly good at the point. Fernando,
couldn't there be a little Cleveland hateration here? I think there's a little Cleveland hateration.
No hate in the game. My man.
He's won like a million MVPs. You know, he won
like
the
a million?
Championship. Yeah, like about a million, give or take. And he won the championship last year. He was unbelievable in that championship. And he's been carrying the Heat throughout the playoffs. I mean, Wade and Bosch haven't been that great throughout the playoffs. They were great last night, but not they haven't been playing at their usual level in these past few weeks. And LeBron really has been sort of carrying them. So I reject that notion that he's a choker. I think it's based on a lot of sort of phobias about him.
Okay, well, Michael Skolnick.
I'm a Knicks fan, but okay. I gotta show love to Bron and D Wade. You know, I'm not Chris Bosh, not so much. But you know, last night was the Dwayne event. D Wade showed up last night. That guy's a true champion. That guy knows when crunch time is crunch time. He showed up last night and carried that team last night. Bron can't be stopped. I mean, at any given time, that man cannot be stopped. He by far is the best player in the league. And Game Five is going to be critical. You know, Game Five is you know, give or take who wins that game, that's who's going to win the NBA championship.
Paul Butler on the record.
Tim Duncan is the man. He's representing for us old heads. And so, you know, he gets tired.
Man, he got two-inch vertical.
He shows up every other game. So he's a little sleepy last night. I understand that Game Five he'll be back, and San Antonio will bring it home.
All right.
Jimmy, I'm sorry. Did I mention again that Jimmy's from Cleveland? There might be a little bit of hateration involved. Just thought I'd share that little detail about that.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. Attorneys in the George Zimmerman trial were grilling potential jurors all week. Yesterday, the judge said the jury will be sequestered. Michael Skolnick, you were actually in the courtroom this week. Can you describe the scene?
Yeah, I went down there for the first few days. As some of you know, I sit on the board of directors of the Trayvon Martin Foundation and have been very close to the family over the past 16 months. You know, it was emotional. It was tense. There was protesters and supporters outside. There was every member of every media station from around the country had a truck there and was inside the courtroom. I think for the family, it's just remarkable to watch them with their poise and their grace and their humanity, you know, sit in that courtroom and hear the things being said about their son. Yesterday, one of the potential jurors, E81, said that Trayvon's father wasn't present during his life and that he was a bad kid and that he deserved, you know, to be killed somewhat. And just, you know, to watch their reaction, to keep the poise and the grace and the humanity throughout this whole thing was remarkable. They're an incredible, incredible family. And to sit in that courtroom and just listen to these jurors, you know, talk about what they know, what they potentially know, what they think, is very, very difficult for them. But they're holding up. They're doing well. Zimmerman's wife was there the whole week. She has a bodyguard with him. And, you know, George was very calm and collected. I walked by him a few times in the hallway, which was, you know, kind of bizarre and weird. But, you know, he's been, you know, very sort of calm through this whole thing. And it looks like they'll pick a jury by the end of next week, hopefully. In this case, we'll go to opening arguments about a week and a half from now.
Paul Butler, well, you're a former federal prosecutor. What do you think of the way things are going so far?
I think that we have to understand that none of the lawyers in this case want objective jurors. As a prosecutor, you want people who are going to send Mr. Zimmerman to jail. So you're thinking about everything that matters, including race. And here, it's a little different from what a prosecutor usually looks at. Here, if you're a prosecutor, you want black jurors. You want people who are going to understand that even though Trayvon was no choir boy, that's coming out now, he had all these pictures of weed and involvement in fights and a cell phone. That's true of lots of victims, and it still doesn't mean that somebody has the right to fire on them when they're on the street. So I think African-Americans are going to be more sympathetic to that than the non-African-Americans.
Is that appropriate, though, Paul, for people to be seeking out to – I mean, if it's the other way, when a prosecutor is trying to bar blacks from a jury – that would be considered – that's a constitutional challenge, right? You can challenge that, the findings. Is it – what about if it's the other way?
It's technically illegal, but this is the barbershop, right? So we're keeping it real. And since race matters and since prosecutors want to win their case, they have to look at race. I mean, you know, you can disguise it. Sometimes the law lets prosecutors and defense attorneys a lot of leeway. So you don't say it's race, but keeping it real, it's important. It matters.
Fernando. Is there any tension down your way between brown and black folks?
Between brown and black? I mean, you know, not. I don't see it specifically due to this case. You know, I think the family of Trayvon has been very eloquent in sort of calling for a peaceful proceeding and for nothing to happen. I mean, I think that. I mean, I think race obviously plays a huge role in this case, but I can't see tensions boiling over in the way that it did with Rodney King or Arthur McDuffie down here in Miami back in the 80s.
Can I ask you, Fernando, though, you know, a lot of times sure. there are parallel conversations going on. I mean, there are people having different conversations depending on where they see themselves in that story. And I was just curious, kind of in the Latino Twitterverse, for example, or in bilingual Twitterverse or something. Is that are the conversations different than the ones that people are seeing on like the so-called mainstream media, or the general audience media, or even the black media?
You know, George Zimmerman is technically a you know, white Hispanic, or I mean, these things are always very, very difficult to you know, these issues of identity in the Hispanic community are always very difficult to parse through. But I haven't seen like overwhelming Hispanic support for George Zimmerman because he is Hispanic. That just hasn't been happening. You know, it's his Hispanic identity is largely based on sort of, you know, on his lineage, not so much his culture, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. It does. But his brother has made a point of pointing up that lineage in the wake of this trial. In fact, he was on our program, and among a number of others, making a point of emphasizing that lineage, and that's why I was interested in how people were responding to that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's really sort of made a large effect in the Hispanic and how the Hispanic community views him. I just haven't seen that.
If you're just joining us, we're having our weekly visits to the barbershop. We're joined by writer Jimmy Israel, law professor Paul Butler, journalist Michael Skolnick, and Fernando Vila. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Okay. So Kanye West, a.k.a. Yeezy, a.k.a. that other dude, is dropping a new album next week called Yeezus. He gave a kind of bizarre interview to the New York Times. He says he's an anti-celebrity. His music comes from a place of being anti. Huh? How about
you
that, Michelle?
You thought it was bizarre? I thought it was brilliant, awesome, and strange. I feel like if we did not have Kanye, we would have to invent him.
Okay.
Because he takes the place, he has the place that, you know, the black prize fighters used to take in our society of just saying the most crazy things, demanding that you look at them and being just so in love with themselves that you can't turn away. And it's riveting. It's theater. It's like, to me, it's like theater every day.
Okay. I like Yeezy because, you know, he feels as if he has to take his respect in a very ferocious way. And so far, he hasn't done a Terrence Trent D'Arby. I mean, he hasn't overpromised and underdelivered. You know, he hasn't failed flat, you know.
Jimmy, you're going after Bron Bron, and now you're going after Kanye and putting this.
You're not listening. I said, I'm down with him because he has not failed yet. I'm down with him because, you know, he's taken his respect.
He got eight albums.
Okay.
Let me just let me just quote from the article.
Sure, go ahead.
Remember when he grabbed the mic from Taylor Swift a few years ago at the MTV Music Awards? He said it's because Beyonce was robbed of Best Female Video. He apologized back then, but then he says in the interview, he said sorry because he gave into peer pressure. Quote, it's only led me to complete awesomeness at all times. It's only led me to awesome truth and awesomeness. Beauty, truth, awesomeness.
I respect
it. That's all that is.
I respect his swagger. Paul Butler. Prince Paul, what's your take on Kanye?
So this is the Andy Warhol of hip-hop. He's super commercial. He's a marketer. It's no coincidence that we're talking about him on NPR the week before his album comes out. But he bridges in the same way that Andy Warhol did, high art and pop culture. I mean, he said crazy stuff in this interview, but he also referenced making his album by going to the Louvre 5 times. He talked about architecture and design. When was the last time you read that in a hip-hop interview? You know, he's a genius.
I agree. He's the Andy Warhol, and but he can fall flat any moment, be the Mark Kostabi. Yo, Mike Skolnick.
Man. I mean, I think here's one thing I think we don't talk about Kanye enough. I think Kanye has offered us and given us so many gifts that are actually political and talk about issues in our communities that most people don't talk about. Yet he also talks about gold diggers and things that, you know, are just pop culture and commercial. I mean, he gave us Jesus Walks. He gave us No Church in the Wild. He gave us, you know, Made in America. And then he gave us this record, New Slaves. And in the record, he's talking about private prisons and how private prisons, you know, have teamed up with the DEA and trying to lock everybody up. I mean, this is a guy, yeah, he walks around and says how great he is and how awesome he is, but he's also pushing a lot of buttons. He goes on national television and does New Slaves on national television straight into the camera and says, white America, deal with it.
He's like a Pentecostal preacher with a sampler. I'm down with him.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
So let's move on. You know, this happened earlier in the week, and I'm still scratching my head. Chad Ochocinco, is he still an American? Chad Ochocinco Johnson, he's behind bars. What happened?
Yeah, well, okay, I know, it's a puzzling story. He was in court for a probation violation. A plea deal was on the table until the judge asked him if he was happy with his lawyer. He said yes, and then he tapped him on the butt, you know, in the way you would if you were on the field, right? And then the judge was not pleased. Here's a clip.
This isn't a joke.
I didn't do it. That's a joke.
Everybody in the courtroom was laughing. I'm not accepting these plea negotiations.
No! Oh, Joe Klinko!
And he got 30 days for that.
Man. Was this a judicial overreach, or should Johnson have known better? Paul Butler, what do you say?
I say this judge needs to get a life in times. I mean, come on. It was funny. And it was the Ocho was respectful to the judge throughout. He called her Your Honor and Yes, Ma'am, and he does this one thing, and this does more to undermine the integrity of the judicial process and people's confidence in judges than anything that Mr. Ochocinco did.
Fernando, I heard you're angry about your former Dolphins player.
Yeah, and local Miami boy. The judge kind of also said, you know, you should thank your attorney. He was great throughout, you know, and so it was a strange thing. I mean, 30 days in jail. I mean, that's a long time. I mean, it's I wouldn't want to do 30 days in jail, and to do that just over a butt slap. I mean, it seems like the most ridiculous thing. Especially, you know, he's been. I mean, the amount of butts Chad Johnson has slapped in his career and his life probably is in the tens of thousands. So it's like it's almost like a natural reaction for him. It's just a very, very bizarre thing.
But do you think, I mean, he's already on probation, though, for headbutting his former wife, with whom he was married for, what, like 10 minutes or something like that, Evelyn Lozado, who's, of course, famous from the basketball wise. I mean, do you just feel he should have shown better judgment, or do you think that, you think it's just like overreaction?
If the judge would have given him 30 days for violating his probation, then that would have been fine. But it seemed clear that the judge was willing to accept this plea deal and then changed her mind when she saw the butt slap. She was on the path to accept the plea deal and then changed her mind. It just seems very, very strange.
I just wonder if this is like a cult, like one of these diversity things where a person in one world, it's like this person in the other world is like an alien to them and they don't feel that. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, it just feels like this weird cultures colliding moment where.
I,
Right. I mean, I wasn't there, well, so maybe she thought he was clowning. Maybe she thought he was clowning the whole time and wasn't taking the courtroom environment seriously.
The takeaway here is definitely judges do not respect a butt slap and a smile. You know, you gotta keep it moving. I mean, don't be slapping butts in court. What's wrong with you anyway?
Own dude.
Especially when a black man does it. I mean, again, right? Let's be real.
Bingo!
Yeah. Dead really giveaway.
So, yeah, I mean, it's of a piece with the ways that every problem that every... you know, kind of disciplinary thing that a black boy or man does, there's a criminal response. So it's not that different from when kids in school do stuff. If it's a white kid, she goes to the principal's office. If it's a black kid, they call the police.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
Also, I wonder if the court, the bailiff was laughing, everyone was laughing. If the court hadn't laughed, would the judge have reacted the same way?
But I think it makes I think it makes a bigger mockery of the justice system. I think that by the judge doing that, we laugh at her. Like, yeah. Really? You're going to give him 30 days for slapping the man's butt?
Exactly.
Yeah. Give him 30 days for hitting his girlfriend in the head, his wife in the head. 30 years hitting his wife in the head. 30 days for slapping your man in the butt?
Okay. And Charlie Sheen is walking around free. There is no justice in America.
No, how about that?
Lohan left rehab.
Well, speaking of this, quick hit on this, Michael Skolnick, Tim Tebow, former Jets player, will now don a Patriots jersey. And I just thought, since you're up in New York.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Tim Tebow is just not an NFL quarterback. He shouldn't be in the league as a quarterback. If he puts on a few more pounds, he could be a tight end. But he's like a Geno Toretta. He's a Cade McNown. Good college quarterback. He just don't have the arm strength. He's a marketing tool. Like, if you want to sell jerseys to folks who go to church, like, okay, you know, put him on your team. If you want to win some football games, you know, leave him off the roster.
Oh, harsh, harsh. Jimmy, you agree with that?
He's not on the Browns. He doesn't exist to me.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Jimmy Israel's a writer and culture critic. He's adjunct professor of film at social media at Cuyahoga Community College, with us on our D.C. studios, along with Paul Butler, law professor at Georgetown University. From our bureau in New York, Michael Skolnick, editor-in-chief of Global Grind, and Fernando Vila is director of programming for Fusion, an ABC Univision venture, with us from member station WLRN in Miami. Thank you all so much.
Thank you,
fellas. Great to be here.
Game five.
Remember, if you can't get enough Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's leave out on some Kanye, and let's talk more on Monday.